Hey there, folks. We're kicking off today's episode with a cup of tea from the Nepal Tea Collective. Nepal Tea is a social enterprise based in New York that distributes the freshest organically grown teas to different parts of the world directly from smallholder farmers in the beautiful country of, you guessed it, Nepal. You can join us for a cup of tea and be part of the global impact they're creating by visiting nepalteacollective.com. That's nepalteacollective.com. Yikes, my cup of tea is already getting cold. So, why don't you join me and hop into today's episode?
From growing up in rural Kenya to standing at the forefront of building and using cutting-edge technologies over the past 20 years, Joseph Makoha joins us in the boardroom this week to unpack a life and career like no other. Joseph currently holds a PhD and master's degree from Stanford University and practices research and engineering at the intersection of people and technology. In research, he studies the role of artificial intelligence in creative, high-performing teams. As an engineer, he designs and implements deep learning and AI models and takes leading edge technologies from concepts to real products and services. In this episode, Joseph explores the role that leading universities like Stanford have had in shaping the future of global technology trends and how their counterparts in the global South can create a similar impact. Joseph takes us down his incredible journey of building successful startups and the lessons he has learned about life, business, and technology. Join us in the boardroom for another guest episode taking a deep dive into the life of a true visionary.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you are, whoever you are. Welcome to the Boardroom Banter podcast. You're joining us for yet another guest episode. We release these every Tuesday, and on our Fridays, we release Founders Friday episodes. So just like you're used to, today we've got a fantastic guest in the boardroom. But before we get into that, my name is Sean Karanja. I'll be hosting you today alongside Mr. Boniface Omina. Boni, how's everything going?
Hey everyone, it's a local noisemaker, feeling fantastic today. Happy to be back in studio. Both hosts are back and ready to tag team against today's guest. It's not going to be, today we're not pulling any punches. You know, we've been really waiting to have this conversation with this specific gentleman, and we're super, super excited. It's been good.
Absolutely. Boni, if our listeners remember, and hopefully those who are listening did not skip our past Founders Friday episode where we were talking about the dystopian future that could be if, you know, some of the episodes we've watched on Black Mirror. For those who don't know Black Mirror, it's a show on Netflix that just basically sheds light on a near future to come and the different technologies and how we'll interact with them. Some episodes are spooky, some are cool, some are weird, and we studied one of them that was interrogating the role of AI and generative AI in the media world. And, you know, it was looking into a future where platforms such as Netflix, etc., could even take your likeness, right? So like your face, your facial features or whatever, somewhere in the terms and conditions, and replicate it and use that to make content, etc. So we really went down a deep rabbit hole on AI and its applications, and, you know, should we be worried about it, etc. And that's why I'm super excited about us having today's guest. His name is Mr. Joseph Makoha, and he is currently at the forefront of researching the role of artificial intelligence in creative, high-performing teams. So he's got an engineering background and, you know, is basically an expert in deep learning models and AI. And I don't want to misrepresent his work or put any words in his mouth. So without further ado, Joseph, welcome to the boardroom. We're super excited to have you here. and we cannot wait to dig into some of the work that you've been doing as you were exploring your PhD in Stanford, but also right now the work that you're doing at University of Oslo. Karibu sana, Joseph.
Hey, thanks very much, Sean. Nice to see you again, Boniface, after almost, it's almost a year because we hang out last summer.
Yeah. Nice
to see you, Yuri, as well. This is exciting to have a conversation with you. I'll just pick up from where Sean has left it. I think it's a very interesting opportunity to explore ideas about technology and the future and wellness and sustainability and development and all these interconnected issues. So very excited to be here with you guys.
Awesome, Joseph. So if someone wants to figure out what you do, who you are, give us a brief intro. Who is Joseph? And, you know, walk us through some of the work that you do, some of your interests. What do we need to know about you in order to get a bit of perspective later down in the conversation as we dig into some more interesting technical stuff with you?
Yeah, so Sean, you're being very nice because the questionnaire that you suggested to look at said that I need to be able to describe this to a 10-year-old. And so that comes with very, very clear constraints as to how I can characterize this. So I'll try the 10-year-old version and see how it goes.
And then try 10. If you can't hack it, we'll maybe bump it up to like 16-year-old, maybe.
Yeah.
We're not going past 16.
About this. Actually,
we're not going past 16.
Yeah. So I was thinking, I would probably tell a 10-year-old that I'm this middle-aged guy who builds stuff and sometimes breaks them. I teach people how to build stuff as well. And I generally work in helping people to be more creative. And so that involves a lot of different avenues. For example, I teach. I'm also a startup founder. I've co-founded 3 different startups in the last decade. I hang out with young people and talk about ideas. And this is just an example of how my work's life pans out, or how I would characterize it. So it's around ideas, helping people be more creative. And with my engineering background, I tend to like building stuff. I talk about it and then I actually build it. So let's start with that.
That's beautiful, Joseph. That's beautiful. And as one of the young people who you have taken time to, you have created time to spend and have a couple of conversations with, I remember quite fondly when we first met and, you know, we introduced ourselves to each other and we later on, you know, sat down for a coffee, me, you, and Yuri. It was actually closer to a year ago than you think. It was right around this time, last year. And we had conversations. You showed us some artwork in the coffee shop that had the Sergey Brins, you know, different startup founders and accomplished entrepreneurs who have been in Stanford and have been canvassed on the wall. It was quite the experience, Joseph. And one of the first conversations that we had together was on your identity as a Kenyan and your heritage, right? And one thing that this conversation really did, and this topic is, you know, we got to relate with you a lot more, you know, despite the fact that the environment that we're meeting in wasn't our home country, right? And you had spent tons and tons of years in the United States. And I think I'd love to give the listeners an opportunity to get to hear a bit about your story and where you come from and be able to relate with it just as you and I did. And so my question to you would be, for us to understand who you are today and the work that you do, what do we need to know about the early childhood environments that you were in leading up to you traveling to the United States?
So yeah, I'll do the short version because I suspect there are lots of other interesting questions coming ahead. I grew up in Western Kenya in Butere. I make this joke, but I tell people I'm actually serious, that in primary school we didn't wear shoes. Only the teacher was allowed to wear shoes. Like pupils were not allowed to wear shoes. So I make the joke that today things have changed and, you know, primary school life, even in the village, is a little different. Then went to high school in Kakamega, had a very exciting learning experience, both primary and high school. Joined University of Nairobi, where I did electrical engineering, and actually got my early foundation in computer science because this was in the 90s. We didn't have computer science as a degree. So you found a lot of the mathematicians and electrical engineers generally going into computer programming. So I remember one of the things that differentiated me from many other students was actually launched my first business, serious business, when I was an undergraduate. And so I used to do electronics repairs. I ran a little electronics shop in Buruburu at the time as a student. Anyway, long story short, I eventually left Nairobi and moved to California in 2002. I wanted to explore different opportunities, and it was just a chance that happened that I could go to the US. So settled there, two master's degrees and a PhD later. I moved here to Norway last year in September. So that's a very, very brief snapshot. And then we can talk a little more maybe around my engagement with the technology ecosystem in Silicon Valley. My engagement with Stanford as an entity, it has shaped a lot of my experiences and my worldview. I spent 11 years at Stanford, both as a student and employee.
That's really cool. Yeah. So you are in the heart of Silicon Valley and you've seen a lot of stuff get built out of there. I'm really curious to know what was being built, right? So over 11 years, I can just think of, I mean, when I look at my own life in the past 11 years, the world has changed significantly,
yeah.
Right? So over the time that you were at Stanford, what were some of the trends going on, current affairs at the time that shaped both your interests, yeah, but also the research you were doing and the startups that you were building?
Yeah, so I'll split it into two terms, that is the 2000s, which is when I had just moved there, starting to live and work there. And then the 2010s, which is more recent, you'll probably relate with that a lot more. So in the early 2000s, Sean, I just want to point out, first of all, Google was not a thing as it is yet. We did not have maps. If you wanted to go somewhere, you could use Yahoo and then kind of print it. And once you printed it, you get on the road and you have a printout of the map. So, and we thought that was revolutionary because you are coming from having to buy a map for every city you visit. There are actually maps. You still find them today for ferries and other. Anyway, so just think about it. The internet, it was still Internet 1.0. And then things started changing. We started having a lot more mass participation on the internet. So you're talking about blogs. You're talking about having threads where people can leave comments. This was, it didn't exist until the 2000s. So today it sounds like, what? So what did people do on the internet? Remember, if you wanted to read a story, you literally downloaded the story and maybe you printed it or you saved the page, because if you refresh the browser, it's gone and you start all over again. Anyway, so technology was not where it is. And Internet 2.0 happened around my time, my early time in the US. Now, starting 2008, something else happens. 2007, 2008, Apple comes up with the iPhone and opens this thing called the App Store. It was a very strange idea that you have a phone and then you download apps. And that totally transformed a lot of other spaces, because think about it, that's how social media became a thing. Because previously you had to take a picture on a standalone camera, then go to your computer, transfer that picture using a cable to the computer, and then have software to manipulate that photo in a form that can be accepted by the social media website. It was a very onerous process. And then it becomes possible to literally take a picture on the phone. There is an app there that sends it over. You could document stuff. You could actually have conversations and record them in real time and do all sorts of things. So in terms of media and information, in terms of services, in terms of how businesses could interact with users, because this allowed businesses to even start tracking who are the people coming in and how many places. If it's in a mall, you could now say how many people visited, how many stores. So I go in with this and I go to five places. You can actually track that. And applications that helped create business value out of users having this thing and having the phones and the internet started exploding. And then one last thing I want to connect to this is access to data, to bandwidths, being able to use data on the phone. So remember the way companies work, the phone companies, you need a lot of people to make the services cheaper. So having mobile apps that consume data then created an opportunity for these big companies, the telecommunication companies, to build out the network, because now you have critical mass. You have almost everyone using these services. And I will jump ahead and then we'll come back later. So I see something going on with artificial intelligence today, which is my current area of focus. As AI becomes a thing that the average person uses, it's also gonna create a lot of interesting business opportunities that we don't even know yet. We can only speculate, but as this becomes a thing that everyone kind of uses and it provides some value to the average person, it's gonna be a whole other revolution. But we can come back to that topic a little later. So I only talked about technology. I talked about social media. That was a thing. I should say environment and sustainability started becoming a thing. So we start figuring out, you know, what's after you use this phone and it's dead, what happens to it? And that starts creating new opportunities, challenges and opportunities. We start figuring out who are the people who are making these things that we use and what kind of life do they live? What are the conditions that they live in? Now we are talking about minerals, where the minerals that are actually building these technologies coming from, and what are the conditions those people are living in, and how do you make this equitable and fair? How do you make the benefits that we accrue from all these resources benefit as many people as possible? So these are issues that have been developing, and some of them are still center stage. Some have kind of gotten too complicated. You talk about privacy and confidentiality and data security and so on. And yeah, it's still ongoing conversation about this.
So what did your work look like? So I know that you did your PhD at Stanford, and while you were doing that, you were also running a couple of businesses. So let's take a look into your work life. What was that like, and what have you been working on, working towards up to date?
Cool. And I'll do a summary of that too. So I taught
Right.
in public schools for a while. I used to teach mathematics, which is not a favorite subject in many American schools. So I taught from 2003 all the way until 2008. I actually took a little break during my master's at Stanford. I taught again a little in 2010 when I was finishing to support myself. After that, I launched a startup with a friend. We started building iOS apps. This is when Apple had just opened the App Store and said, any developer who wants to learn how to do these and use it. So we jumped right in, ran that for a year. I had a goal to raise funding or go get a job within a year if we didn't get funding. And it was a very interesting lesson, Sean. I'll give you one pointer, and which is a lesson for most startup entrepreneurs. I tell them this story. We had a chance to create mobile apps for a very respectable entity. And because the person who ran technology there was my friend, on the very last meeting after I've met the team that is working in IT and who we were going to collaborate with in order to create the app, I'm like, look, if you pay me to do this, we're going to have to keep charging you to do updates and to build the new one and new versions and so on. Why not grab a few of these people and teach them how to do this stuff? Because I had just learned in the past half a year how to do it. It was very new developing iOS apps. So yes, they switched from that and decided they were gonna, instead of paying us, they're actually gonna build a team. And most of their team didn't want to do this. They're like, no, we don't want to learn a new thing. So it was not an easy sell for him. Anyway, long story short, I think we lost a huge opportunity to have that first customer that was is a big name on our list. No, in hindsight, I was like, that would have got us huge funding already just to have that first customer. Anyway, long story short, I think I helped my friend look good, but then I lost a business opportunity. So after that, we worked, launched a few apps, but then I went back and got a day job at Stanford as an academic technology specialist. So what we did is my job for 11 years was to understand any new technology and figure out how we can help researchers and instructors at Stanford to use it. And it doesn't matter what the technology is. It was my daily job was to figure out what are the new technologies. I would meet with startup founders whose products were still developing. We would sometimes test them and work with them to help them build the product so it can work in an enterprise or academic space. So I got to learn and meet and talk to a lot of startup founders and have built connections with a lot of them, some who have become extremely successful, but I've known them from when they were still building this little thing.
Wow, Joseph. I think one of the reasons why we love the topic of artificial intelligence on this podcast is because we've taken time to really understand this thing from different perspectives. And what I mean by that is, for example, we've had on the podcast builders of this technology, right? The coders behind AI and the people who are really driving this technology. We've also had ethical critics, right, who have poked holes in aspects to do with ethics in AI. And lastly, I think this is where it really starts getting dicey. We've had conversations with educators about artificial intelligence and the role that technology plays in shifting some of how, or rather, better phrased, how the role that emerging technology plays in changing our curriculum and really adjusting our academic angles and perspectives towards where the world is moving towards. And a couple of some episodes ago, around episode 58, we had a lady on the podcast known as Gabby Immelman. She runs a company in South Africa called MindJoy, where they teach In other words, they teach teachers how to teach better using AI. I stand to be corrected, my listeners. Please head back to episode 58 and let me know if I was accurate on that one. But one of the things that she did bring out is the fact that when it comes to learning institutions, universities, colleges, all the way down to high schools, the stakeholders of these institutions cannot seem to agree on what the role of the school is, right? Teachers feel like the role of the school is X, Y, and Z. Students feel like the role of the school is perhaps, you know, to be a holistic learning environment, right? They want this holistic experience from school. Employers believe that school is meant to get students ready for them in the workspace, right? Impart skills and all this. And I'd be very curious, you know, coming back to your story, Joseph, to explore the role that academia plays, academia, universities, these institutions, in shaping the global tech space and global business trends, right? And so when we look at the employer side of things, through your experience in Stanford and over the years, not just as a student or a product of Stanford, but someone who has also come back as an educator in the same environment, what are some of the ways you feel like Stanford in itself as an institution over the past 11 years has played a role in shaping what goes on in the business world?
Yeah. I like the way you've characterized the mixed expectations from stakeholders in learning and in education. And that's a whole other topic on itself. So back to the role of academia. And I'm going to say this just for clarity, Boniface. I think I have a slightly narrow view because of where I spend most of my time. Spending time at a university like Stanford gives you a very deep dive in a very specific mindset that is around doing and building. As you know, yes, we learn the theory, but if it's just theory, I don't care. Like, yeah, you can have all the ideas you want. You can philosophize. I don't care. You need to build it, do something, act in the world, and act in terms of from a very, very engineering mindset where we build technologies. So that's why I told you that I have a slightly narrow view because of the experience of being where I was. And part of the reason I clarify that is because I believe academia can exist just for the sake of knowledge. It's okay. And there are universities that do a very good job of preparing people to be thinkers and to criticize and to do all sorts of other useful work in society. But Stanford, to be honest, is a very, very unique kind of space because of where it is and the connections and the networks it's built. So this is one environment where the university serves multiple purposes. Yes, we go there to learn. I can assure you a very large number of students who show up at Stanford are there because of the networking. They are there because they could find this knowledge if they wanted to. They can find it. But they come to network with the Nobel scientist, physicist, you know, or writer. And they are using that knowledge to then help them build the skills and what they need and the connections that will help them then go launch a thing that impacts a lot of other people. Remember the Steve Jobs comment around like an idea is cheap, but it's just an idea. Like it's not a business. It needs a lot of things to actually build a business out of any idea. And so students who come to this these kinds of universities that are very focused on, and there are quite a few now. It's not only Stanford, it's just Stanford is unique in a lot of different ways, location too. But yes, it's to learn, to connect, and sometimes to actually raise funding while you're still a student. And these are the ways, in my opinion, that academia is able to affect the outside world. There are lots of industry university collaborations. I traveled to China twice while I was a student, once funded by Intel, developing, they were attempting to develop some technology solutions, and they used a student team to do the exploratory work. And the second time, it was by a major Chinese real estate developer, and they were interested in developing smart cities and smart buildings and were curious about what kinds of services would constitute smart services. And yes, so they worked with a student group, gave us the challenge, and we ended up networking, finding opportunities for jobs, and also being able to go continue doing the work that you start in class. You can go to industry and continue building that. So something that was an idea in a classroom now finds the funding that comes with a big company like Intel, or a major real estate developer. I'm avoiding naming names of certain companies and people because I'm being, I want to be nice to everyone. But yeah, these are moneyed entities. And so they have the student collaborations, and some of them will find the bright minds to hire, and those bright minds then find a place to go and extend their work. The other point that I kind of thought about is the university is it has a high density of talent and sometimes public funding. This is very common in the US, not in many, many other places. Here in the EU, yes, also. So I'm in Norway, and the government funds a lot of research and even startups. So the university allows a very, very high concentration of brilliant minds, highly driven people, and a place where public funding can be put in without a lot of controversy, because you can say, well, we are funding people in a public university. So, you know, if we lose some money or it doesn't return profits and so on, it's not a big problem. And that's part of the reason a lot of research, cutting edge research in the US actually comes out of research universities. I'll give you one final example to reinforce this. SLAC, the Stanford Linear Accelerator Lab, is a very, very, very high cost, difficult to maintain in terms of talent. To find the kind of people who can run that kind of research is very hard. And to find the funding to then fund it is extremely hard. And yes, the federal government uses taxpayer money to pay for this project, because this is the only place you'll find both the scientists, so the talent you need, and the capabilities that are going to go with it, and a vehicle that can accept huge federal funding and manage it correctly. So these are just examples. And yes, the internet that we are using right now, many of the technologies in the microprocessors that are running the computers we are using and the internet servers, these have come generally from research, a lot of it in universities, that finds its way into the market.
That's pretty impressive. And I was reading up and seeing that another reason why universities have such large endowments and resources is that they also act as investors in one way or another in a lot of student enterprises. So if you think of the Stanfords, etc., where things like Google were being built out of it, and now the university has a bit of stake in a couple of these innovations that went on to be billion-dollar companies. I mean, it makes sense that they would invest heavily in that pipeline of high quality students, etc. Because I remember back when I was in high school, I used to wonder, you know, I'd watch a lot of these, you know, on YouTube, you see lots of guest speakers, guest lecturers. So you find someone who's, you know, a billionaire, you know, tech mogul or something is teaching a class at Stanford GSB, you know, and it never used to click in my head at that time until I really looked into it and found out that, you know, that's one big incubator. You know, yes, it's a university, but I mean, it's one big incubator where the best of the best ideas come out, and those networks are really maintained over time. Now you've gone to, I mean, right now you're at University of Oslo. You've spent, you know, a good number of years at Stanford, and you've seen what it takes to get ideas from the classroom into the marketplace. As people who are currently based in Africa, as an African yourself, what are some best practices that you've observed some of these university institutions that are best of the best globally? What are some of the best practices you've seen them doing that you believe possibly if we were to start applying those, we could start to get to that point where we're seeing, you know, University of Nairobi, University of Ibadan, you know, we're starting to see some unicorns coming out of these places. Because to be quite honest, a lot of us, when we go to these institutions, we say, okay, I'll start my startup in my dorm room. I don't want to involve the uni. I don't want, you know, because also there's no resources. So how do you think that Silicon Valley, Stanford mindset could be best applied here?
So Sean, you are really making it challenging with that question. So, I will entertain. How should I put it? I will entertain just thinking and imagining about it, because that's all
But you. In the boardroom, we think and imagine, you know, nothing is set in stone here.
Yeah. Delusional in here.
Because I'm like, there is not a very clear-cut answer. But to step back a second and then come back to the question around how universities might nurture these kind of outcomes. You mentioned something that I had thought about but forgot to talk about in terms of universities and academia moving some of the best ideas into industry and into products and into things that really improve people's lives. So there is something called technology transfer that is a very major vehicle that Stanford now uses to take a stake in the companies. So I've not checked or confirmed this, but I remember that Stanford probably didn't get a cut out of Google. And that's the company that made them realize that we need to figure out a way to actually get just a little bit, because we incubate these. We, you know, the ideas are created using some of our resources. So they came up with a way to do this. And so they have an office of technology transfer. If you're a student and you have a good idea, they will talk to you. They will actually help you fine-tune, clarify. If there is intellectual property, they have the lawyers who will help you figure out the IP and even help you get into a program that helps with funding. And that's how they take a little stake in the companies early on. And I think that's a very viable vehicle for academia to actually both support and benefit from these brilliant ideas that the students they enroll conceive. Now, in terms of thinking about Kenya, thinking about Africa, it's a question that I have been asked many times, mostly by well-meaning people. It's sometimes been at an airport, it could be at a reception, a concert, a party, and I rarely have a good answer because, and I'll tell you why, Sean, and then I will go into the imagining part. It's because that narrow experience that I just described again, having been in Silicon Valley at Stanford, this one place, I understand the history of how it became what it is. And people have tried to replicate these. They have got the money. They have tried to get the best brands and all that. And it just doesn't work because you need not only the ideas, you also need crazy venture capitalists or, you know, it could even be just parents and friends, not necessarily big VCs, but you need people who are willing to take a risk with young people who are inexperienced, but who are crazy enough to dream of some idea. And that is a cultural thing, Sean. It's very hard to replicate anywhere that you're gonna let young people who've never, Sean has never built a $1 billion business, but he tells you, you know what? I have a $1 billion idea. And you're like, okay, Sean, I'm going to give you a little money and actually I'll introduce you to somebody who can help you a little. So it's more of a cultural thing, but also I want to highlight the amount of resources that flow into Silicon Valley. There's lots of investments. People are willing to put a lot of money there, especially people who have enough money such that if they lost 100 million, a billion, 5 billion, they are not going to go hungry. So to get these kinds of people to actually then, I mean, you've seen what happens with the stock market and, you know, some of these guys, they lose 100 billion. You know, the guy who lost 100 billion in a few days, you know, it happens and he's not poor. He's fine. So you have to find people who can deploy such huge financial resources. And young people who are also willing to take a risk. The other part that I want to add to this, for the sake of the young people who will listen, is that you also need a pool, a large pool of young people who are willing to work very hard. If you work just average, no, this is not going to work. And this is some controversy I normally have with young people when they talk about, well, but I need to feel my wellness and balance. And I'm like, okay, that's not how these great companies would be. Unfortunately, we are trying to get there, but not yet. So you need young people who are also really willing to say, I have an idea and I'm really going to hunker down to get this idea to work.
Wow. Since we're on the topic of comparing Africa and the rest of the world, Joseph, I work a lot in the music industry, right? And I speak to different artists about, you know, their career paths and how they view what they need to take the next step in their career and so on and so forth. And one of the things that has always come up is the gap that you've pointed at of, you know, funding needs to be risked somewhere, right? And I think back to like the exams that we used to do in high school, right? I went to Lenana School and, you know, I did business at some point and a number of different subjects. But one of the challenges to starting a business that we'd always cite, even in our incubators at Watson, you know, when we were in Silicon Valley last year, capital, you know, capital deficiency, inadequate capital, right? And I think one thing I'm hearing from what you're saying is that there's a model that has been built in certain universities that ensures, for example, the example that you used of the school supporting you and then getting a share of that success. And so I'm guessing it's a loop, right? It's funneled back into the university or back into a specific department. And so there's a culture that has been built, there's a cycle that has been built, and it's sustainable and it's working, right? So in that exact topic of sustainable models that work in some parts of the work, but are a bit more difficult to figure out here on the continent and in Kenya, for example. In the topic of sustainable models and what other institutions and other places in the world have been able to get right, what can Africa learn from this, right? Are there any specific gaps that we can assume, right, is the reason for some of these inefficiencies in our models, and how can they be plugged up? And is it people resources? Is it knowledge? Is it, you know, do we need to change our leaders? You know, what's your take on that, Joseph?
So this is a very appropriate question. And Boniface, I know that you are asking knowing you're not going to get a full answer. But this is we are here to banter. You know?
It's both exact. You said it, Joseph.
Now that we opened Pandora's box of hypotheticals,
yes. So might as well go back. Down this rabbit hole. Yep.
This is my bantering, and this is my dreaming. My dreaming is that one, within the contexts in Kenya and in other African countries, that young people will find clever ways to actually transcend the challenges in funding models that have worked elsewhere. So I'll give you an example. To build, pick a company, Google, for instance, to build that, you needed to figure out how you're gonna, first of all, manufacture enough servers that can deploy around the US and Europe, and then move to Asia, South America, and everywhere else. And how are you going to connect this stuff? First of all, how do you manufacture it and deploy it? So you have an idea, it works, you can test if you have a connection, but how do you even create that? So the amount of capital investment that you need to build that kind of idea is relatively prohibitive. And to do a proof of concept at the time was relatively prohibitive. So think about today, and I'll pick one of my favorite spaces, software. You can actually do software and proof of concept without huge financial capital. You can build services that help people around Nairobi or around Kenya using much smaller capital outlays. So that's just one thing. And then the other one I want to point out is in terms of the customers. Just a friend posted last week on Threads, the Meta forum, that in, I think, by 2050, one third of the world's population will be in, the 15 countries with the highest population increase, 5 out of the 15 are African countries that are going to have some of the highest population. So, and these are young people, mostly young people, an educated population, people who can actually do stuff. So yes, we know that that creates certain challenges, but what does that say about the opportunities that arise? What kinds of services can we be preparing Africa or Kenya and other places to provide to the rest of the world? I'll give two examples of inspiration. So if you think about what India did with software engineers about a generation ago, they invested a lot in training in their IT, especially computer technologies, invested a lot in top-notch training, and they supplied software engineers for the rest of the world for a long time, literally for the last one generation. They have led in that. Right now, lots of countries, European and US, I'll pick Norway where I live right now, they need a lot of pharmacists and nurses. And these they're importing from Pakistan and other places. Just last week, I saw in the news that countries are now putting very, very strict restrictions on nurses leaving to go work in another country. It's not one country, like a lot of countries have just said, no, we can't keep losing our healthcare personnel. So these are interesting inspirations. They raise other questions as well, but I can use them as an inspiration to say, yes, you know, Kenya or African countries can actually develop certain kinds of talent that can provide value to the rest of the world, while also really improving the lives of people in Kenya and in Africa. So you work and provide services, you earn a good living wage, well, above living wage, and that helps you to provide better lifestyle to the family and the children, then the outcomes are probably gonna also be much better. So the question for me is, what are these spaces that we might invest in? My suspicion is a lot of it is going to have to do with skills and skills around technology. I would also say an inspiration is I'll remember the country. There's Singapore. That's the country I was thinking about. Yes, Singapore is a good example of where they have really concentrated on knowledge-based services. They don't have natural resources, nothing else, but just knowledge-based resources. And I think this is an opportunity in Africa as well.
So let's talk about the elephant in everyone's room and on everyone's laptop and phone: artificial intelligence. We are at this space where there's this brand new technology. I'd say that it's been a while since something truly new was in our hands, and you know, we could use on a day-to-day that was actually quite impressive. I mean, just the other day, you know, you can talk to anyone. I mean, the barber, like I was at the barber the other day, and you know, the topic of will AI replace you, he was like, nah, you know, I'm irreplaceable, you know, who else is gonna cut up your hair like this, you know, like he was really advocating for himself. But you know, you can tell that the AI conversation has permeated a lot of levels in society, and that's a space that a lot of your active research is centered around, and specifically around how can we use these AI tools to enhance our creativity and productivity. So roping in your most recent response about, hey, you know, as Africans, maybe a way to get ahead is to become a talent pool for tech-focused, you know, individuals. Let's get our youth to adopt tech-based skills, maybe entrepreneurship, something like that. Where do you see AI in all of that? Because some people are thinking this thing is going to replace the need for people. And, you know, as a continent that's about to have a lot of people, AI can be looked at as an existential threat, because our people need employment. And if this thing is replacing that manpower, you know, there's a bit of a dichotomy there happening of, is this good? Is this bad? What has your work been focused on? And how are you seeing the AI-human interaction moving forward? And maybe what can our listeners take as take notes on, and just, you know, adjust their focus a bit on how they're relating with this new tech?
So you are right on that. Yes, there is there's a subsection of human work that some AIs will definitely take over. I see fireflies.ai not taking on this computer. Yep. And my opinion, it's actually transcribing our conversation into text in real time. And I'll tell you that during the pandemic, I was in charge of running my weekly lab sessions for DesignX. This is the team that I did my PhD in. So I ran the weekly meetings through the pandemic. And My advisor was hard of hearing. He would not be offended to know or to hear what I've said. So we actually had to pay a human subscription service. Somebody would log on and actually transcribe the conversation as we are talking and try to transcribe so he could see. And at some point, we started seeing these voice-to-text applications come, and we started using them. But they were not as good as the human. But now I see you don't even have a human. So yes, that takes away a lot of jobs, because this one program running on one server can transcribe for thousands of users, where you would have needed a one-on-one, so those would have been 1,000 transcribers. You just have one program, and as long as the connection is good, it does the job. So yes, this is going to happen. On the other hand, I think one of the most useful things I can do for the listeners is to, and I'll try to do this in a minute, is to clarify that AI is an amorphous term. So when we talk about artificial intelligence, we can talk about different kinds of AIs. So the one transcribing for you is an AI. Yes, it does some of the damage you mentioned. If I need to unlock my phone, I just looked at it and there, it unlocked. And it, you know, it can lock again. And I look at it and it unlocks. There is an AI that is working there. It knows when I'm wearing glasses, if I grow a beard, if I cut my hair, it would still know me. It's an AI that is doing that. The voice assistants and other personal assistants, those are AIs. Elon Musk and trying to have a Tesla drive by itself from San Francisco to Los Angeles. That's another kind of AI. The license plate readers that, you know, we use for security sometimes, or to, you know, these are different forms of AI. So they come in many, many, many different forms. So when you talk to users, Sean, try to push them to actually clarify what they mean when they are talking about dangers of AI. And they can be very specific. So language models like ChatGPT are a kind of AI that has become very common. Unfortunately, it has taken a lot of the bandwidth, and people think that's the only AI. No, it is a conversational AI. And then we have the DALL-E 2 and others that do images and video. And yes, there are dangers that come with those. But overall, I think the benefits of AI outweigh the risks. The reason I say this is because I suspect at some point we are all going to be a little more conscious and careful about how we deploy these services. Worst case scenario, somebody is going to get sued in the US or in EU for a lot of money for building an AI that misbehaves. And then that's going to cause the others to say, no, we don't want to pay that much for a mistake. And in general, that's the way it happens. Somebody does something, they are hit very hard with a huge fine, and the other companies say, no, we are not going to repeat it. So that's my naive bantering, if you ask me, Sean.
That's an awesome take, Joseph. You know, when you mentioned Elon Musk, as you're giving the example, I thought you were going to say, Elon Musk, he's an AI. He's a human AI. that wouldn't have been too unbelievable. But
quick one, Joseph. I mean, sorry to interrupt.
But, no, go ahead.
How far do you think we are from singularity? So machines getting human level. Intelligence and awareness. Intelligence, computational power. They've already passed us a long time ago, but like,
yes,
Lenny, so, I get an AI on the podcast and we have a great convo.
So this bantering is getting way, way more exciting. So in terms of singularity, I think you will want to also be clear about what level then really, really, really qualifies as singular, because we are talking about
Terminator level
can be aware and can feel. And that is, so they use the word sentient, sentience. It is a very human characteristic. And in my, this is my understanding, Sean, that machines can do certain things better than human beings. Machines can do certain things faster with fewer mistakes. But there are many other things that machines cannot do. So I look at machines, including, so think about what's an AI. All the AIs I described to you, it's a computer program. Somebody opens a scripting document and writes the first character and builds a program that does all that. So these very wonderful programs are, that's what they are. They are computer programs. And so we can try to teach them. So say teach them as much as we want, but it's very hard. I'll give you one reason, since we are bantering. You can teach a two-year-old to tell between a cat and a dog very easily. So they see a thing, you tell them, the two-year-old, you tell them, this is a cat. And then they see it has four legs, a tail, a head. They see a dog coming and they say, cat. And you tell them, no, that's not a cat. That's a dog. And they're like, well, but you said cat. You say, yeah, that's the cat. That's the dog. Next time they see a cat, they'll say cat. They see a dog, they'll say a dog. It takes so much to teach a computer program to differentiate those two things. And to differentiate Sean from Boniface. It's very hard. If I pointed to a two-year, three-year-old kid and said, that's Sean, that's Boniface. And I keep showing one picture and say, who is that? They'll tell, no, that's Sean. That's Boniface. No, that's, it takes thousands of images to train a computer to learn that. So there are certain things that humans can do very, very well. Like, is Sean smiling? Is he frowning? Is he happy? Is he annoyed? Is he smug? Is he making fun of me? Like a human being, a kid can tell that, yeah, that's a genuine smile. Oh, no, he is kind of making fun of me. It's not a smile. A computer can never tell that. So if you are having that conversation you're imagining with this sentient machine, it's going to have a very hard time figuring out whether you are smiling. And lo and behold, if you had them talk to a Norwegian, because they have a very different culture, and that culture manifests itself in ways that I have to show you a picture that is on my phone, and it's showing different faces of a Norwegian. The first one is somebody is happy, and then the next one is sad. The next one is angry. And then the last one, drunk. So full means drunk. It's the only difference you see is between the first three and when they are drunk. Because expressing emotions the way Sean is doing is not common. So how is a computer going to know that and say, no, this is not a Kenyan. This is a Norwegian, so I should understand them differently. Anyway, you say this is the banter, the boardroom banter.
This is the banter.
That's incredible. Yeah. Maybe quantum computing might change that, because perhaps it's a lot of the examples you're giving is within our present day capabilities of machines.
I think quantum computing might accelerate that direction, but being able to actually put the capability in a machine is where the challenge is. How do you instill a human characteristic in a machine?
What if machines teach themselves how to do it?
They still need knowledge. So remember, machines need a knowledge. So when we talk about machine learning, there has to be a source to learn of knowledge. Where is it encoded? Yeah, okay. So that's okay. It, this is a, so Sean, I should just have a call one day and talk about AI and sentience and the philosophical issues around it.
definitely. Anyway, Joseph, we've gotten to the end of our conversation here. And I mean, it's been incredible. It's been incredible. We have our final segment, and we call this the elevator segment. Yep. So picture this, right? I know you've been in Silicon Valley. You're familiar with an elevator pitch,
yep.
Right? So picture this. We've just had our conversation in the boardroom. You're on your way out, hop into the elevator. You're about to go down into your self-driving car that's not yet sentient yet. And just in the elevator, one of our interns steps in and has a couple of questions for you. So we're going to ask you a couple of quick fire questions.
Yep.
If you're ready, let me know and we shall dig right into them.
Let's go right on.
Okay, perfect. So first question is, what does the future hold for Joseph?
Teaching, traveling, raising my now 12-year-old twins, and enjoying my middle life years.
Amazing. If you could drop everything and build something, anything, what would that be? In a business or, you know, life sense, you're just told you've got the rest of your life to drop everything. Money's not a question. Unlimited funding from some crazy person. What are you building?
So I am actually starting to build what you're saying. Money is still a problem because I still care. But to your point, I would actually concentrate on building knowledge capacity amongst African youth. And I'll just throw this in. Right now, I'm recruiting young people in Nairobi. Actually, the person I was supposed to be talking to in 10 minutes, I texted her and said to give me 10 minutes, I'll be late. So I'm recruiting young people that I'm training in machine learning and AI, hoping that they will then train other people and they'll found companies and they're going to do other things that can improve the lives of not only people in their community, but actually around the world. So that is actually kind of my midterm life plan. And maybe I should have added that on the first question you asked, but I missed it.
Yeah. No worries. All the best with that. We'll see how we can help you.
Final two questions for myself, Joseph. The first one, if you were to come back to Kenya and teach in any institution and teach any subject, which institution would you teach in and which subject would it be?
I'm extremely biased. It would be Nairobi University. And I would probably teach design. I did a little bit of this. I got stuck in Kenya in 2009, and I spent the summer 2009 at UON EE building. And yes, I worked with students in a summer program to kind of get their skills. Mm-hmm. They were engineers, but trying to get them into thinking as designers and not just engineers.
Wow, super. Super. Last question, Joseph. You know, we listen to a lot of podcasts and we see people asking their guests, what's the best piece of advice you would give our listeners? Yada, yada, yada. But you know, Bodrum Bata, you said we do things the opposite way. And so my final question to you would be, what's a bad piece of advice that you've come across in your life that you would advise our listeners never to take?
I will. It's a very easy question for me. It's trying to ask a young person what they want to do in life when they are 10 years, 12 years, 15 years, 18 years. It's like, no, look, the possibilities, I didn't know.
Leave us alone.
I came 2 years ago.
Leave us alone.
Yeah, so that's the worst thing, worst piece of advice. It's like, oh, you need to pick what you want to do and what you want you should be. Like, you guys on the podcast, I hope that's not your mindset, that you know that you have not even figured out what you're going to really do, the thing that is going to impact. You're just gaining knowledge and building a network, period.
Period. Sean, did you get that?
Wow. No, definitely. I think that's something I've been learning a lot, especially from my mentors, where when I look at their life trajectories, and even here on the podcast, when you talk to individuals like yourself, etc., a lot of people had very counterintuitive life paths. And so to attribute someone's trajectory to the thing they studied in high school, the grades they got there, what they studied in university, or what they're good or bad at, it's a very, you know, tunnel vision type of way of looking at a human and attributing, you know, what their traits are and what their interests would be. But also we ignore the reality, which is life. Life is life. Things happen, yeah. Experiences happen. Tastes change, we get older, we get wiser.
Yeah.
So that's really great advice, Joseph. To everyone who is listening, we want to thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of Boardroom Banter. We had none other than Joseph Makoka right here talking to us about basically how his experience out in Silicon Valley, from the academia standpoint, but also as an entrepreneur, has shaped a lot of what he teaches today. And he's at the forefront of technology such as artificial intelligence. And just as you guys have seen, there's AI everywhere. And I think, Joseph, what I'm really taking away from this conversation is that tools are tools. Tools are everywhere. What really matters is how we use those tools to build stuff, to go out and make an impact in the world.
Exactly. And
as we do so, understanding that there's certain trends in place that we need to understand and learn about. So it's really exciting to hear that, you know, you're going to be teaching people about machine learning, etc. Because, yeah, as Africans, we need to be at the forefront of all this stuff. If we don't get onto this tech train, we might be left behind. But we want to thank you so much for the work that you're doing out there, for coming onto our podcast as well. And for our listeners, I hope you guys have learned something. You can go out, find Joseph Makoka out on LinkedIn, send him a message, tell him you listened to the Boardroom Banter podcast. If you have any more questions you want him to banter and hypothesize about, feel free to do that. We shall not publish it officially, but you can have those side chats with Joseph. So Joseph, thank you so much for joining us in the boardroom. To all our listeners, if you made it this far, shout out to you. You can find the rest of our Tuesday guest episodes out on all platforms, as well as our Founders Friday episodes. We know you've missed our Founders Fridays, and we released our recent one last week. So hop onto that to catch up with us, Boniface, Yuri, and myself. And yeah, that's it from us, guys. Have a great week ahead and all the best.